Context, Caroline Casey. So it is our Equinox show with our splendid guest, whom I will bring in shortly. But first, Michaela Gaston and I are doing an Equinox Zoom tonight at 5 p.m. West Coast time. You can find out about that at coyotenetworknews.com. It's just by dedication, any old thing. But it's deliberate dedication to democracy. Citizen Trickster's Vernal Guide to Saving Democracy in a Very Spooky Time. So gather. And we'll be proffering the Astro Mytho Political Vernal Strategy Guide to Being Participatory Earth Citizens. Cooperators are standing by. And as Ami and I have done for decades, we lay it out, and then Ami will invite, chant, and drum the cooperators into our field of play. For every outrage, there's a balancing intelligence, or Orisha. For every toxin, a tonic. So we step into the traveling now. The equinox is the balance point, equal night and day. Terry Pratchett says, magic is easy, just find the fulcrum and push. And many other things that we will undoubtedly unfold during this hour. So, more than perfectly, we welcome fellow water dragon, Brooke Williams, scientist with the soul of a poet. So let's all be intimate with the world by being able to read it symbolically. It's spring now, when we are reminded of the opportunity, responsibility of being human to borrow, perhaps it's one quality, to borrow qualities of intelligence from the flora, fauna, fungi with whom we share this earth, now in so much peril. Brooke's latest book is Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. I'm so grateful to this book. Brooke Williams writes about evolution, consciousness, and his own adventures, exploring both the inner and outer wilderness. He lives with three cats, a dog, and the writer Terry Tempest Williams near Moab, Utah, where they watch the light and wait for rain. His website is brookwilliams.site. Welcome, Brooke Williams.
Thank you, Caroline. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's really great. I'm so grateful to this book. I just have to say, with unconflicted enthusiasm, it's like, you know, intimacy and so many qualities, you know, as you dive us into dragonflies. And I realize just a few little things, you know, just reading about it and you bringing it back into consciousness. Years ago, when there was an earthquake just outside Washington, D.C., I stepped outside and there were dozens and dozens of dragonflies having sex in the air. And I go, whoa. What an interesting response, I said. And they were hovering over my mailbox. And I go, oh, it's a message. Anyway, isn't that quirky? Have you ever seen such a thing?
No, I've seen some fairly large swarms before, but never in the act and never after an earthquake, for sure. That's amazing.
Right. It is amazing.
Something got stirred up, right?
And when I was visiting Hawaii, friends of mine there said, oh, we knew you'd be coming by because the dragonflies came, and they always tell us that you're coming. And I go, I'm very honored.
Whoa. Yeah. There's so many stories like that, aren't there? I mean, there must be something to it. There's so many different stories of ways that people encounter dragonflies that have never really experienced it before, and then there they are, and it's unforgettable.
Yeah, and you say, you know, they're everywhere. People have tattoos and people wear amulets. And you said, you know, when your sister was dying, my sister just died. You'd been hoping. Well, and a brother and a cousin. And in February, it's been busy. But but you'd said, you know, over and over again that many people and yourself thought that dragonflies carry the souls of the dead.
Yeah, that's something that's pretty widespread culturally. And I've heard so many stories of people that find out I'm obsessed with dragonflies, and they say things like, you know, it was so strange. I was at my uncle's funeral, and once it was over, we went outside, and there were 15 dragonflies all around us, and we'd never seen them before. I don't know what it is, and there's got to be a reason, but it's so prevalent that there must be something to it. The story that you tell is my sister had a stroke. She was in hospice. They knew she was not going to survive. And I had this thought. I spent most of my time with her. I had this thought that, unfortunately, it's too early in the season. It was spring. It was this time of year. It was too early in the season to really see dragonflies. And I thought to myself, I bet if it was the right season, I would see a dragonfly right now, because she's about to die and her soul will need carrying away. And then I met this woman in the elevator with a necklace that had a dragonfly pendant on it. And she said, go ahead.
No. I'm just.
It was so uncanny, because I said, like I always do when I see something like that, I said, oh, I love dragonflies too. She said, yes, I love how they fly. I love their colors and everything about them. And the elevator door opened. She walked out and she turned to me and said, and you know they carry the souls of the dead, don't you? And then the doors closed and she was gone.
Life is a dream. No, and I love so much. I feel so kinned, you know, with your, dedication to restoring our intimacy with the world by being able to read it symbolically, and the to and fro dream world to actual world, and how so many. Well, you talk about the cave art, and that they're carrying messages. And have you seen the movie The Cave of Forgotten Dreams?
Yes, isn't that spectacular?
It is, and the reason I bring it up also is that it's great, because it's Werner Herzog, who is grumpy, perfect. He doesn't come in with fixed ideas, and he's moved by these oldest cave paintings in the world, and there's
and aren't
this
they beautiful
moment.
Though?
Oh, stunning! The horse, these 25,000 years old more, and 5,000 years later, somebody paints another horse next to the original one, and there's flutes, and there's a fire pit, and there's this moment, and I'll toss it back to you, but there's this moment where we see Herzog seeing it. I think he even closes his eyes, and he goes, so people gathered here for over 5,000 years, they played music, and they shadow danced between the fire pit with the art. So the art was not merely to be seen, it was a portal, it was a doorway. I love that.
I love it too. The idea of art, you know, being more than just something to view, but to something to interact with, I think is such an amazing idea. I think about it all the time.
Yeah, and the to and fro, and you guide us into dragonflies have been here for 300 million years. Yeah.
Oh, I know. Yes, I know that. There's that part I wrote about, which I thought about for a long time, just imagining the first, it was a coal miner who discovered that early fossil of the dragonfly they now refer to as Meganeura, 300 million years old, which means it survived the main mass extinctions throughout history. It's an amazing creature, and it's so big. I guess there was more oxygen back when it was living, because it's probably the size of a magpie and probably hunted not only other insects, but also small mammals. Imagine that.
Hmm. Yeah. No, we want to imagine that. And then, you know, that over and over they are in your life and in art and in biology, that they are messengers between worlds. Again, the portal theme. And I just have to mention another fabulous synchronicity. So for our astro sky map of now, of the equinox, Uranus, nature's trickster genius, quintiles, 72-degree angle, Ceres, Demeter, dwarf planet, goddess of the Earth. It's fairly specific, 72-degree angle. And when you were born, Brooke Williams, Uranus quintiles Ceres exactly to the second. And it's like, oh, and the quintile is irresistible eloquence on behalf of what one loves and the capacity to open portals between worlds. So
you are that
all the time, and you have that all the time. And the equinox has that for those of us who raise our hands going, yeah, we'd like to do that too. But this idea of portals between worlds. Yeah,
that kind of
isn't
explains a lot of things for me.
How so?
I mean, it's kind of been my life, even though it wasn't always smooth. I grew up in a Mormon family. Brigham Young's my great-great-grandfather.
Yes, and you have the mug.
I have the mug, Right, have the mug. And so I spent a lot of my life trying to figure that out and then how to figure out how that was not for me. Yeah, it's always been full of inquiry. I think my whole life has been having a question and then figuring out the answer to it, even though I was a bit naive. But that seemed to come in handy a lot.
Yes. And you know, reading your book, and it, you know, it again alerts us to, it opens portals for all of us to feel where there's that to and fro and the synchronicity, and that whatever we love or pay attention to or study is how synchronicity will speak to us. And I love that. So yeah, every part of book, you know, opening portals, and then to tease us into now, right, this equinox, right, the time of regaining balance, you know, but it's such an insane, dangerous time out there.
Right.
And I do like, as I'd mentioned, thinking that, you know, what distinguishes our species aside from our rudeness, it might be, you know, our capacity, our necessity, opportunity to borrow qualities of intelligence from flora, fauna. And I had that in my mind all the time. I'm reading your beautiful book, Encountering Dragonfly, going, well, what are the qualities of dragonfly that we might want to invite in at this equinox, you know, to come into balance, to come into our personal collective lives? I mean, I have some thoughts from your from your book, but anything that comes to your mind now,
yeah,
is welcome.
I think about that a lot. But first, let me just back up a step, because when you introduced the program, you said that same quote, we borrow qualities from other intelligences. And
yeah,
I thought about that a lot, because it applies to dragonflies for me, but it also applies to every wild creature out there, that
yeah,
it's not limited to dragonflies, but these qualities, these intelligences are around us all the time, and we've just forgotten how to look at them. As for dragonflies, you know, the main idea, which aside from pretty much across the board being messengers, or excuse me, carrying the souls of the dead, they're messengers between worlds, between the inner and the outer world. And if I think about that very carefully, and again, my best quality is my naivete, so you might have some, let's say, solutions to some of these problems that I've created, but the inner world, I think, is the unconscious and maybe the collective unconscious. And I've tried to read a lot about that, and it seems that the collective unconscious is the entire history of our evolution, including everything that we ever needed to save ourselves. And if we are getting messages from the inner world, which is the collective unconscious, which does hold our entire evolutionary history, then, and dragonflies are bringing that to us, maybe we ought to take a hard look at them. And I really think that it is a matter of consciousness, because I think we've sort of run out of solutions. I mean, how many times have we gotten bruises on our forehead from hitting ourselves with our palm when we see what happens all around us all the time? And we can't really figure out what it is. And it's that some attribute Einstein, but I'm not sure it is, but the idea that we can't solve these problems with the same consciousness that we created them with, I think is more evident than it's ever been right now. What do you think?
Oh, well, yeah, no, I was, the practice of re-enchantment and participation, you know, I mean, it's everywhere. Just even the astronauts who, thank God, made their way back on a SpaceX rocket from,
yes,
9 months in space. But when the rocket lands in the ocean, dolphins surround it and are frolicking. And the news commentators go, oh, isn't that cute? But I remember, you know, again, science and mythology, when the Challenger explosion happened and seven astronauts died, I think that was 1986, and when they scattered the ashes of the seven astronauts who died, seven dolphins swam around it. You know, and the scientists were like, oh, wait, there's five, there's six, oh, there's seven. You know, again, you know, the innocent
dignity
of our childhood.
Can you believe the coincidence?
Yeah. Well, right, the synchronicity, it's like, it's,
yeah.
So
you can't make it up.
No, it's very profound, and it's speaking to us, you know, all the time. And it is the most needed quality, I think, now, what your primary dedication. It's so wonderful. And then, well, the qualities they have, we'll get to the word you love saying. Oh, I have it written down somewhere here in my notes, omnidivium. But dragonflies can change direction instantly, right?
Yes, they're spectacular flyers. And they don't fly that it's not like they can fly like a hummingbird, but they're much more mobile and much more versatile and backwards, forward, side to side, you name it. And that was one of the things I discovered that I had no clue about. And it wasn't that long ago. I've been thinking about dragonflies for 20 years, but only recently did I discover this part on their head, which is between their two giant eyes, which are spectacular in and of themselves, allow them to see 360 degrees. Just the amount of information that goes into those bulbs is spectacular. But this middle eye, this third eye, they call it, is called the ocelli, and it's actually three simple eyes that allow the dragonfly to maintain the horizon and also navigate between light and dark. And the fascinating thing about it is that this ocelli is connected through neurons, a few of which go to the brain, but most of them go directly to the wings, so that they can make these amazing maneuvers while they're hunting without even thinking. What they perceive goes right to their wings, as opposed to what we perceive goes into our brains. We figure out what to do with it, and then we make some kind of action. But they don't really even need to think, and as a result, they never chase their prey. They ambush it. And they may be the most efficient flying predator on the planet by many factors. Like, apparently, I've just read something where they're 90% effective in their hunting, where the closest other flying predator, which I'm not even sure what it is like 35 to 40% effective. So it's an amazing thing. And the most troubling part of it is, the reason we know so much about this third eye is because the Department of Defense is experimenting with how to turn it into a technology for drones.
Of course. Which
would be amazing for them. Yeah. Of course.
Right.
Of course.
Right. Of course. Right. And so we call on, if we don't know what to do, invite in what does, but can change direction instantly. I'm just going to pause going, that would be useful to us now. And it reminds me of David Graeber's fantastic book, The Dawn of Everything. Do you know this book?
Yes. Yes.
Right. So remember, he wrote it within 10 years, died before it was published, but he wrote it with this dedication. You know, again, it's kind of a dragonfly connection. He goes, always remember that human communities have had the capacity to change direction in an instant. And wow. And he gives all these examples, like Teotihuacan, like, you know, warrior sacrifice, war. No, we've changed. He says, you know, apparently instantly. So I just want to put this on our altar. Never forget the capacity to change direction instantly. You know,
I've thought of a lot of metaphors that dragonflies have for me, but that's brand new, and it's something I just made a note. I'm going to think about that a lot, because that may be the most important thing we have to deal with right now, like you said.
Yeah, and then the eyes, and the hunting, the huge eyes, as you said, see nearly 360 degrees, and then there's this word that I will try and say, but you say you love saying, omatidium. Right.
Yeah.
This
is a part of the eye structure, and I don't have it really memorized. It was one of those questions that I had to go like do some serious research about. But that is a great word, omatidium. It's a part of. There's the lens, and I think then there's the omatidium, and then there are these filaments. And I imagined that inside, if you were miniaturized yourself and you were able to crawl inside the eye of a dragonfly, imagine it being like mainly filled with these almost vaporous filaments that go from the lens and the omatidium, which there are thousands of in one eye, you know, connecting it to the brain. So it would be like a, I don't know, I imagine it as being like a chamber of gauze or something.
That's great. And it's it's a wonderful new word for us all to learn, omatidium. And I just, again, yes. We're bringing up everything that's ever been useful. A woman was making puzzles, and she wired people's brains up. And she said, when people put a puzzle piece in place, the brain has a little orgasm of delight, like, ooh. And she said, yes. The same thing happens when we learn a new word. Our brain has an orgasm of delight, like, ooh, omatidium, ooh.
Right? Yeah.
So
I guess that's what happened to me.
you had a brain orgasm when you heard the word.
I did.
That's great.
I didn't know how to describe it, but now I do, yes.
You had a brain orgasm. Well, or that's just, you know, one way of describing it. We don't know.
Yeah.
But it's like, so language, one of the great technologies of participation, but so also your great long dedication of observation. So have you seen the movie Flow?
No.
Okay, I wish I could transport myself and watch it with you and Terry Tempest Williams. I've been talking about it, you know, every show recently. I've seen it 4 times, but I would put it together with your book and also Aaron Caffell's books, just as useful for now. It's so wonderful. It's Latvian, and the TV turned it on by itself, right? Again, synchronously. I'm like, what's this? I thought it was the news.
Whoa.
Oh no, it's the real news. So it's no humans, which is a great vacation, no language, but much communication. And it's about how to navigate a collapsing world with mutual aid. It's
Whoa.
Fabulous. It's Whoa. Like the real news. So I just bring it up because it's Flow. And the reason the connection to your work and life is part of what many things I loved about it. And I did see it 4 times the last time I managed to find it in a theater going, is the incredible, it was made by one person who then hired 4 animators on an open source, and there's no AI, open source thing. It was made for $6 million, which is like nothing. And then it won an Academy Award after I discovered it. You know, but the incredible, reverent observation of animals is like, oh, it's so, you know, how a cat moves, right? You have your wonderful cat, Winslow Homer, right, who is now an ancestor, right?
Well, Winslow is a dog. There are 2 cats,
oh.
Issa and Basho. But you're right. Winslow passed last summer after 14 years. May he rest in
yeah.
peace.
Well, there's a great dog character. There's a great, you know, there's a great animal characters. And it's about, you know, for us and for you, and I would put it in a cultural festival, we would put, you know, Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. I'd put wonderful Aaron Caffell's books, the past radio shows, and the movie Flow all together going, that would be exactly the medicine we need for now, reenchanting. You know, so anyway, I just put that, I mention it almost every show just because I'm just wildly enthused about it. But
I'll make sure I find it.
Yeah, you and Terry will love it, I think. I'm pretty darn sure because it's like, oh, it's a dream.
I bet we will. I bet we will.
It's a dream within a dream, you know, and it's a pertinent dream that is relating to us and you know to make friendships across species
yes.
Is essential is part of the movie's offering. So anyway, so okay, back
is
to
it
you.
Recent?
So
is
yeah,
that
just
a
now.
Recent
just,
movie? Oh, just, a,
just
so it
now.
Won an Academy Award just now. Wow.
Yeah, just
Fantastic.
Now for animation from Latvia. From Latvia. Who knew?
Wow.
I didn't know.
I'll go
you know,
find
it's
it.
Like, yeah, no, it's findable streaming, all that. And, you know, it might even be playing in Moab, which is a pretty hip place. And if not, you can insist,
yeah.
you know, bring it here.
So,
and then, so back to the dragonflies, you know, and navigating a collapsing world. So their wings, the dragonfly wings, have antibacterial qualities. Speak to this.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Yes. Just the way they can filter bacteria out of the air. It's like they're, and again, we know so much about them because they, I mean, this whole idea of biomimicry, which I'm sure you've talked about a lot on your program or you've heard a lot about it, this idea of copying
yeah, yeah, yeah.
nature. And that to me is a much better use of a dragonfly than a drone for wartime. But that idea that there are these little microscopic mechanisms on their wings that actually filter pollutants out of the air, and I only started thinking about it because of a dragonfly that I felt bad about. There was a number of them. I was at the edge of this, actually a reservoir, a ranch reservoir. It was surrounded by there was a layer of moss that was maybe, went out into the center of it like 10 or 12 feet. And I didn't see any dragonflies. I walked out on this pier, this dock, and I must have scared some because there were 12 that just started flying around. One of them like dipped too close to the moss. The moss trapped it, its wing, and it drug it down. I was able to find some kind of implement and drag the big mat of moss into shore, pulled off the dragonfly and tried to clean off its wings. And while I was watching, doing that, I had never been so close to a dragonfly wing before. And I just started asking myself questions about it and looked up more information and found some scientific paper about this. And I'm amazed by it.
Yes, I'm right on that page of your book, page 181, where you talk about that synchronicity abounds. And you say, right, exactly what you just said. What if they were also pulling bacteria from the air with their wings? And then you talk, these 10 billion fingers trap airborne bacteria with such a tight grip that the bacteria destroy themselves trying to escape. I want to pull that into our political strategy. I want to pull that into our political strategy. 10 billion fingers trap the toxin, the airborne bacteria, with such a tight grip that the bacteria destroy themselves trying to escape. I like it. I like it as part of our, our magic backpack of strategy. It's like the I Ching. Yeah. When Trump was first elected, I thought I Ching, what do we do? And it said, I've forgotten which hexagram it was, but it said, this is the darkest magic. It's where you put five venomous creatures in a jar until one of them kills and eats the others. I'm like, yeah, that sounds right. But the dragonfly thing, it's like with such a tight grip that the bacteria destroy themselves trying to escape. There's a lot I just want to put on the altar of wonder going, how would that translate into a strategy?
I know. It's possible. It's really possible, but isn't it just incredible though that these creatures have been around for 300 million years and they have all these different characteristics. Any creature, there's unlimited wonder and amazement in anything we think about, based exactly like that particular part of a dragonfly's wings. It's everywhere. And I think I could spend the rest of my life just finding out information like that. That would be all I needed.
Yeah, no, that's great. And then, on the same page, I want to go back to how you're an imaginal ecologist and that wonderful reverie and the dream that started it all just helped me to remind you. But on that same page, you go, the power of rituals, amulets, and fetishes. Reenchantment happened to me, but has not allowed me to remain passive. I imagine the full force of enchantment requires my participation. Yes, it's all participatory, right? And, as an astrologer, I love this language, but I don't love how it's often practiced or talked about. It's like, what's going to happen? No, it's not what's going to happen. It's what's available with which to participate. It's what's the assignment. It's all participatory. You say that. So personal rituals and the gathering and empowering of significant objects access the imaginal world, you write, with its unlimited evolutionary knowledge. Right, and then just for the fun of it, because you gave me your birthday, there are images for each degree of the zodiac. And when you were born, Pluto's image is Zuni Indians perform a majestic ritual to the sun.
Whoa.
Very you.
That's fantastic. And just
That's you. That's your mission, and the power of imagination. It's all we'll dive into it deeply someday. I hope.
I want to.
And it try. It
you know what's interesting, Caroline?
What?
Well, there's a chapter in the book that takes place with a friend of mine, Jim Enote, who's a Zuni man. And what's incredible is the book launch is actually April 1st in Moab at the local bookstore there. And I've been thinking about how this book is really important to sell, and we want to make the publisher happy about it. But the most important thing is this idea of re-enchantment. I feel like that's my work in the world, is to present that idea as a very viable part of the solution to whatever problem it is we have these days. And yes. I made an inquiry of Jim maybe 2 months ago about would he want to be my partner, interviewer, thought partner at the opening event. And only like 2 days ago did he respond to me and tell me that he wanted to. So that idea of Zuni has been on my mind for the past few weeks, trying to figure that out. And then what we would talk about. But then the fact that you said that that's part of the, what did you call it?
It's called a Sabian symbol. It's the idea that each degree of the zodiac has a poetic intelligence.
Another synchronicity. Yeah. Oh. They're everywhere.
Right. Okay, we're being too fascinating. We just blew by the half hour mark. That's all right. We're going to take a very short musical break because I found Fleetwood Mac's song Dragonfly. Do you know this?
Oh, fantastic.
Okay, so here's Fleetwood Mac's song Dragonfly, and we'll be right back after that.
Our flowers and lovely as the king of flies has come. It was a fleeting visit, all too brief. In 3 short minutes he had been and
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Our perfect skookum for now guest is Brooke Williams. His latest book is so wonderful, Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment, completely pertinent. And yes, I had the lyrics to the Fleetwood Mac song somewhere in some important place, but it eludes me. I'll put it in my Patreon notes because the sound quality isn't great. But it's their homage to Dragonfly. It's very much like the haikus that you reference. Yeah,
I loved some of the lines in it about the opal crown set on his head, and then the garden. Was it worthy of such a fine guest? I think it was.
Yes. You heard it. That's really good yeah. for you. Yeah. So here we are, inviting things in at this dark time, and then everything leads to everything. All stories, connect to all stories. So years ago, Sometimes I do readings in person years ago, and it's quirky. Sometimes military guys come for readings, and I'm like, don't look at the uniform, don't look at the uniform, just look at the chart. And so this guy came, and he was quite smitten by me, and he sent me a novel he was writing, which was this really dreadful New Age novel, but it was about unicorns and dragonflies and things, and he was the inventor of drones. And I said to him, I said, you know, this could be used badly. He's like, no, think if you're a little girl lost in the desert. And I go, you know that's not true. You know that's not what this is going to be used for. Right, but it's just that idea that he was trying to balance out his Mars by writing a cheesy New Age novel in some way. It seemed like that happens a lot. You know, Pentagon guys marry artists. Well, Army guys marry artists and hippie chicks. It's like trying to balance it out. Anyway, so that's
interesting to look him up these days and see what's happened, wouldn't it?
Yeah, what happened to him? Right. Yeah, but yeah. I was like, that's enough out of you. What happened? And did you ever get that cheesy novel published? And anyway, and maybe you should turn to that, you know, more. But yeah, just all these quirky things. So, and then wherever we want to go with this wonderful thing, but the judge has just blocked Trump's EPA from clawing back $14 billion in climate grants, right? So we want to invite in Dragonfly, most effective predator on the planet, to help the judges to enforce such things, right? Or what qualities, because democracies, we all have outrage. Ami and I will address this. We have a Zoom tonight, coyotenetworknews.com at 5 p.m. West Coast time. You can sign up. It's by donation only. There you go. It's like, what are the qualities to back up justice? Is there anything that comes to mind about strengthen
the first thing
the
that
judges?
Comes to mind, the first thing that comes to mind is the souls of the dead. I feel like I don't care what political party someone was part of, but I think something happens with death where all of a sudden everything falls into place and things make sense in a very important way. And I would love it if, who knows, Rush Limbaugh died a few years ago. We don't even hear about him anymore. But if, in fact, the dead are all around us all the time, I wonder what he knows now that he didn't know then. And I wonder what he would be telling his followers these days from that side of the universe. I think there's a lot of information there.
That's great. Yeah, my late friend Dr. Wu was treating Lee Atwood when he was dying, and Lee Atwood was a terrible person who made racist political ads and was terrible, 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 but he loved black culture. He loved black culture. He loved jazz, and it was this complete discrepancy. It's like making drones but writing a novel, and on his deathbed, he repented, all the horrible things that he'd done. Going, I don't know why I did that. But I think that's, the souls of the dead come in to, there's a lot of novels about such things, to backstage whisper in going, remember what you came to do, remember what it is to be human, all of that. So good. And then the dragonflies are the most successful predators. You said 75% in your book, but you just said 90% successful in terms of
mosquitoes. Yeah, I heard
mosquitoes
90% recently, yeah. Mosquitoes, right, so, and gnats or whatever, yeah.
Right. So, right, and the whole predator-prey relationship is interesting. It's like, predators are not sentimental. I ate that, whatever. Lewis Hyde says the predator-prey relationship is one of the great engines of evolution on this planet. And he goes, 60,000 years ago, predator brain, much larger. And then you come forward some thousands of years, and predator brain still larger, but prey brain also larger. He said it's working. And he said, but what it doesn't include, and here we send it back to you, is it doesn't include empathy and mutual aid and kinship. And that's the thing also that, Elon Musk saying the greatest weakness of Western civilization is empathy. Yeah. And it's like, oh, lad, no. Empathy is freedom. Being a lonely, bitter, isolated, rich guy, that's prison. That's prison. You're getting it reversed, right? So, so because your life, your book, Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment, so wonderful, so wonderful. I mean, it is about empathy and imaginative intimacy, gazing into eyes, the gaze,
You know, it's, I think it's, if I wanted to put it in very simple terms, there's a really interesting man named Tom Cheatham back in Maine who writes about the imaginal world. And he and I've had some conversations and he's really helped me with this idea. And when it came to me wanting to consider myself an imaginal ecologist, he just said, well, it comes down to whether you treat other as an object or a subject. And I did some thinking about that, and I did some research. And an object we can define as something that we manipulate or use, and a subject something with which we interact. And I feel like that's the key right there. If it's a very simple idea. It's a simple shift in point of view to just be able to consider something, whether it's your cat or your neighbor or a person of color who you don't even know, or a bird or a bee or the smallest gnat, as something with which we interact as opposed to something we manipulate or use to our benefit or kill if it bothers us.
Right. Yeah, no, I know Tom Cheatham. He's been guest on this show. Yeah, wonderful.
What an interesting guy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's all one great worthy conversation, and also you address this in your book. Abstract language, right, is kind of like postmodernism. It's very, you know, when people go on about, well, even spiritual practices, but they go, where's the mango? Where's the dragonfly? Where's the thing? You know, that metaphors and images from nature are the incarnational garb whereby power enters the world, and when it's all abstract, there's no intimacy. I think you address this. Yeah,
I don't think I address it at that depth. I really appreciate that, because that's really the core of it, isn't it? That if you really can't identify what you're seeing because it's all an abstraction, what does that really do to you? I mean, I feel like something happens in your brain when you recognize something. And you know, when you, well, think about attention. I love to think about attention, and I think a lot about what we're talking about is attention at various levels. But if you see something abstract, it's your attention. It has to look at it for a while and then try to figure out what it actually is or what it's supposed to mean or what it means to you. Or I don't know. It's like it doesn't really make sense to your attention, does it? I'm not sure. I'm getting into territory I don't know anything about. So.
No, clearly you do. Clearly you do. No, it's like we've been taught abstraction, like cold modernist steel and glass hard edge architecture, as grown up, right? And it's like no, right. Or a scientific, right? And so I do find you kinned with Lauren Isley. You know Lauren Isley's work. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, the scientist with the soul of a poet, and then I even pulled this off the wall. Because your friendship, your alliance with William Kittredge, is that something? That's something you referenced, yeah.
Yes. Did you know William?
Can we bring him in?
Yes.
No, but I keep this on my wall. Is William still breathing?
No, he passed not that long ago. He was in his 90s, but I think it was 3 or 4 years ago. But you know how that is. It's probably 10 years ago. I can't keep track. But he was a big influence.
It's all a dream.
We actually spent two weeks in the Grand Canyon on a river trip with the Kittredge, Bill Kittredge. It was amazing.
Well,
you had something on the wall.
Can I read this thing that I keep on the wall?
Yes.
Always from Bill Kittredge? He's talking about a raven rattle from the Tsimshian Indians. And this is where Bill chimes in. He goes, "It's a percussive musical instrument used in elaborate ceremonial dances. A simple rattle like the ones we all shook in childhood." Like, isn't that so interesting that we give babies rattles to put them into a trance? Except that this one is carved into the form of a mythological raven caught in the act of stealing the sun back from captivity, carrying the little red ball of the sun in his mouth, preparing to spit it home in the heavens again. That's a striking idea, but not half so remarkable as the beings we see riding on the raven, a human figure reclining back in a posture of sexual openness, and a frog crouching over as if prepared to mount, and their tongues, or tongue, red and slender and arcing. It's a single tongue, and a most remarkable thing is it reaches from human to frog and frog to human. It's all the same in this vision, in which we share tongues with the animals in some perfect sexuality, while our trickster raven redeploys the sun, as in Raven Brought the Light. The unknown person who made that rattle is a glory to our species. See, that raven rattle says, this is how we are, inextricably one with everything, however tricked, riding, in fact, on the back of trickiness itself.
I just got chills. I just love that. Does it say, do you know where that came from? From his work?
No, I have it. Carolyn Raffensperger gave me a copy. 100 copies were printed by Peter Koch with the help of, Jonathan Lederer. I can send you a photo.
I would love it. It sounds like it's one of those broadsides that somebody pulled out from his work.
It's a 1992. Yeah. But I think it makes me weep, especially just see that raven rattle says, this is how we are, inextricably one with everything, however tricked, riding, in fact, on the back of trickiness itself. That's what makes me weep.
Anyway, so there's your friend. Thank you for that. Yes. He was an amazing guy. And he had this presence about him, too, that when he would speak, it's like his body would physically kind of, you could watch it ground itself. And then you felt like the words that he spoke sort of came up from the ground through him. In just a deep and resonant way. He was really an important person in my life.
Yeah, no, I like we're calling him in. We're calling in what we need. We need those words that and what they convey. And it's such a description of anything but everything now. Here we are. We're riding on the back of trickiness itself. So we want to use all those things. So right, and I suppose, it's on Cortez Island. I've been there many times, where you had your dream to be an imaginal ecologist. And then when I was reading it, I couldn't quite figure out because was it a dream or a daydream where you go to the and you go, I'm here to apply to be an imaginal ecologist. Like, we've been expecting you. What was that? It's wonderful.
That's a weird thing that I do where, if I get stuck in my writing or just. Sometimes it just happens to me, but I put myself through this sort of a visualization. And I was told a long time ago, Terry gave me a session with a past life regression specialist for my birthday. Mm-hmm. And I don't really remember the details, but I remember her saying to me, you have a great ability to imagine these images, and I've never forgotten that, and I've always felt like it, and I appreciate it. But when I have a question like that, it's like, do I have the right to call myself an imaginal ecologist? Well, I sort of put myself into a trance, and what's interesting, I'll give you a little backstory on this. There was a conference, so I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and I presented an idea of imaginal ecology a long time before I really knew exactly what I was talking about. And there were maybe 20 people at this meeting, and I led them all through this same visualization. And it got reprinted and put into a book, and it made its way into the internet. Everything that got presented at this conference was in this book, and it's on the internet. So my editor, who I just have so much respect for and has helped me so much. I think I put in my acknowledgments, her name is Penelope, that I acknowledge Penelope for finding what I had hidden. And she was so good at like moving me beyond my own comfort zone. And one thing I guess I was not that comfortable with was this idea of these visualizations that you and I are talking about. And then one day she said to me in the edits, she said, "I'm still a little unclear about imaginal ecology." And she said, "What was interesting is I Googled imaginal ecology and this article came up and it was really good and it really helped me a lot. And oh, by the way, you wrote it." So what I had done is write this thing from a much more naive state, but probably much more clear because I didn't know enough to get it muddled. And it involved this process. So during the editing process, Penelope asked me to consider doing that same sort of visualization around this and around, there's a few other places in the book where I do it. And so what I do is I just put myself in this trance and I have the question and then I just pay really close attention to all the images and not miss any details if I can help it. And eventually something worthwhile happens, which is, I feel like it did in this case.
Yes. I got to tell you, yeah, trance is, I got to say, I'm not imposing astrology. I just can't help myself. So right now, you know, part of the myth that we're all invited to participate in, lest we be possessed by it, is Venus is sinking from the western sky. She's invisible now. She's gone into the underworld. And this is all cultures have their Venus cycle myth. In Mesoamerica, it's Quetzalcoatl, and west, it's Inanna. And then, you know, spends usually 40 days in the underworld, but this time she can't leave us unsupervised, so she's only going away for 9 days, going on. And then she rises, the heliacal rise of Venus before dawn, as the morning star, which is when Quetzalcoatl brings wise leadership back to the world and when Inanna becomes a liberating trickster. And that's when you were born, Brooke Williams.
Whoa.
You were born at the heliacal rise of Venus. If you'd been born and looked out the window before dawn, you would have seen a glorious sight. You would have seen the heliacal rise of Venus that people always watch for. She's back. She's back from the underworld with Jupiter. And with the telescope Ceres Demeter, goddess of the Earth, dwarf planet. But you would have seen those. So you were born at the heliacal rise that we're all waiting for, right? And I just had to tie that in. And then your Venus in Aries, which is where she is now, the woman or the folk hero liberates the whole thing. But your Venus is opposite Neptune, dreams, gazing. And I just got to say this thing that I carry with me all the time. When I first adopted Stella Coyote, I lived with an actual coyote for 19 years.
Whoa.
2 months, 2 weeks, 2 days. Yeah, no, I've learned a lot. There were longer conversations for us to have, Brooke Williams.
yes.
But I had a Lakota elder on the radio, and he goes, "Oh, nothing smarter, you know." And he said, "You know, we Lakota did not hunt alone. Here comes you. Those gifted at trance could go into a reverie and go backstage and broker a working alliance across species borders. So we would all hunt together with the wolves and coyotes. And if you want to destroy the world and our culture, have people forget that." And I just want to say, in your tribe, Brooke
happening?
Williams. What?
Yeah. We need that. Now, that's it. You're talking about, which I love, you're talking about how we can use anything that we know to I mean, if now's not the time to use it, there is no better time. So
no, this is it.
This is it.
This is it, everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody, practice everything you know and even everything you don't know. But it's endogenous to your being, Brooke Williams. You have this capacity.
Whoa.
You know, to experiment. Let's all experiment with, you know, going backstage and apologizing. "We're very sorry. We've been very rude, fire and water. Is there some way we can work something out?" You know, and having lived with a coyote, they know no shame, but it's all wheel and deal. You know,
you're right.
You know, we'd like this. And coyote goes, "What are you putting on the table?" You know?
Yes.
What are you offering? And I think it's always a good idea, but especially now, it's like for all of us, like, what are we putting on the table? You know, if this, if you bail us out, if you help us out, then what is our, what are we putting on the table? We will do what? You know, we will treat this better. We will honor dragonflies. We will, you know, whatever. So I think it's for all of us to do that. But that's why your book is so wonderfully purple.
I think that's an amazing question.
What are we putting on the table?
I'm fascinated. I've been making notes, and I'm not going to forget this. So thank you.
Oh, that's
wonderful. I wrote a book a while ago, and I did some of this same imaginal stuff in it.
Yeah.
And when it came time, the book had already been printed, and it came time to selling it. The editor, who I loved, Barbara Rass, I'm not sure if you know her. She used to work at Sierra Club and then Trinity, and she's a brilliant poet, and she's now my friend. And she was the editor, and she said, well, it's time to figure out where this book sits in the bookstore. Is it fiction or nonfiction? And I said, I'm really intimidated to call this book a novel. I've got so many brilliant novelists that are heroic to me that I would feel embarrassed to call myself one. And she said, well, that's easy then. We'll just call it nonfiction. I said, I know, but I made a lot of stuff up. And she said something that changed my life forever.
Huh.
She said, Brooke, relax. Just because you imagined it doesn't make it fiction.
Okay.
And that's all I ever needed to hear.
Yeah, that's great. No, it's a well, you know, it's like ancient world peers of modern world going, why are you people always separating things that belong together, like healing and art, you know, and imaginal and science and myth, they love each other, you know.
Yes.
They were once one thing, falsely sundered as a mean trick of the reality police, right? And so you're putting it back together, right? Imaginal ecologist, right? Well, you and
yes.
Lauren Isley, you know. Science with the soul of a poet. That's so much what we need. So
yes.
we're exiting all too soon. I'd love to keep this conversation going, and then all homage to your Brigham Young beer mug, right? And yes, Martin Protel says, have around you things that you know their story. It feeds intimacy. It feeds the indigenous soul to have around us. You know, that's wonderful. So is there any last dragonfly wish or homage or invitation you want to put out into the world? There's so much. Oh, Mary Oliver.
I don't know. I would just love it if, you know, if people would let, you know, somehow let me know what they're seeing. I love the stories that come up, because whenever I mention this, all of a sudden it's like a door opens, and at times I'm embarrassed about it, that I want to talk about this in these other worlds, and yet everybody is open to it. And I just think we need more and more opportunities to talk about the full spectrum of the universal life that we get to live. We've been cut off from so much of it. And these dragonflies have helped me, and I think they can help everyone.
All right. We're on our way out. This is super wonderful. I'm delighted to finally meet you, although I think our paths have crossed. Regards to Terry Tempest Williams. This is Brooke Williams, his wonderful book. I recommend it highly, Encountering Dragonfly: Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. Thanks always to Kirsten Thomas, Most Skookum Board Up. I'm Caroline Casey. You can join Amicaela Gaston and me tonight at 5 p.m. CoyoteNetworkNews.com, and we will reconvene next week. And we're having Janine Benyus on in 3 weeks. Yeah, there we go.
Whoa, right. Speaking of biomimicry.
Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.